WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Neil Gershenfeld says that computers won't truly realize their potential to change the world until they get off our desks and into our shoes. Gershenfeld directs the Physics and Media Group at the MIT Media Laboratory, where he's developing something called unobtrusive computing. His idea is to integrate computing power into everyday things like shoes, fabric, paper, refrigerators, and car seats. For instance, one application Gershenfeld worked on was a smart car seat that can detect who or what is in it, a rear-facing baby seat, a child, or a tall adult, and would adjust the airbag controls accordingly. In his new book, When Things Start to Think, Gershenfeld writes that computers don't fit into our lives very well because they're too hard to use. They're too bulky to carry around, too easily broken, and typing is awkward when you're walking down the street. He says that the future lies with technology that's invisible, which erases the distance between us and our machines.
We have a funny divide right now between bits of the digital world and the atoms of our physical world. We've got a world full of capable electronic information. That's really what the digital revolution has done. But there's just one problem. We're made out of atoms, and we will be for the foreseeable future. So all this electronic information is of no use unless it comes out here where we live. And if you look at how the world's set up, there's a neat split between hardware and software, or between physical science and computer science, or you can work on channels or create the content that goes through them. Now, if you step back and look at mature technology that we like a pen or a book or a cello, it's almost anti-technical to say, I'd rather read a book than look at a computer screen. But in fact, a book is technology. It doesn't grow on trees. It grows eventually from trees. But in its day, it was the highest of technology. And it's only very recently we've come to appreciate why books work so well. If you compare the specifications of a book and a laptop, it's really quite striking. The book opens instantly. You don't need to spend time booting it up. You can do fast random access searches through it. It doesn't take any maintenance. It's got great packaging. It's robust. And best of all, it's got a display that you can view from almost any angle in almost any light. And a laptop has exactly none of those specifications. If the book came later, you'd say, my God, what a breakthrough in information technology. So rather than replace the book with a laptop, the more interesting question to me is how we can make new technology work as well as what it presumes to replace along the way to generalizing it. And that's a very, very deep problem in physical science. It's a very hard task. For the books, my colleague Joe Jacobson at the Media Lab at MIT thought that rather than replace the paper, we should replace the ink. Because ink on paper looks so good for a very interesting reason. Have you ever wondered why a piece of paper doesn't need a backlight like a laptop does?
No, but tell me.
Think about it. Your laptop has this bright lamp behind it with this big power supply that you have to keep recharging, and your book next to it looks nice and bright in any illumination without the power supply. The way it does it is the papers and fiber are translucent. You can see through them. Light comes in and it scatters many times. And the mathematics of that scattering light is the same as ink spreading through a sheet of paper. It's diffusion. So this is what takes light from any color and any angle and turns it into a uniform background glow that illuminates the page. So the paper very cleverly uses the light from the room rather than imposing a lamp to display it. So what Joe developed is a kind of electronic ink where you've got particles the size of laser printer toner, but they're actually clear shells that contain smaller particles that are black and white and have a charge difference. So under an electric field, we can move them relative to each other. So you can move the black particles up or down relative to the white particles. And so that means it looks like ink on paper because it is, but it's ink that you can change after you put it down. So right off the bat, you could use this to make paper that goes back through your printer so you don't have to keep throwing away reams of paper. But even better, you could make a book that's any book, a book that looks like a normal book, but you can download other books into your book to read it. there's this polarized debate between books good and books bad. Some people say electronics books will do everything. They'll be online. We can get everything everywhere. Other people say, oh, you technocrats, you don't appreciate the beauty of a nicely printed book. We want real books. But in fact, what both sides miss is that books are technology, but the new digital books don't meet the performance specs of the old books, other than the nice fact that they can change. So if you covered the sheets of paper with this electronic ink, then you can retain the pleasure of reading books like we do now, but now the book can change. One book could be any book. You can access a whole library from your one book. And even better, the next step in this project is to develop the means to print semiconductors and conductors and insulators on the sheet of paper so that you can actually do things like print a solar cell to power it and print a radio receiver to get the data so you could have a newspaper that's always current.
Why don't you give us another example of ways in which you're trying to essentially make technology invisible so that our computers can be closer to us and easier to use and not so unwieldy?
Well, let me jump to the most extreme answer, then we can work back from that. We have this notion that computing is digital and happens in silicon chips. But in fact, the world itself, nature, is a very powerful computer. It knows much more about computation than just digital logic. And up until now, we haven't had to worry about that because the performance of computers has been improving. But that's ending not too far in the future. Around 2010 or so, at the rate of current progress, is where the size of a transistor on a chip shrinks down to a single atom, and a memory cell has a single electron. And at the rate of current progress, the cost of the fabrication plant to build it in the first place becomes the GNP of the planet, so you can't even build it anyway. This isn't the statement that it's going to be hard to make any further improvement. It's just the observation that we're heading up to fundamental physical limits. And so if you want to go any further than that, you have to leave this notion that computers are universal and you don't have to think about the physical system. You have to think more about how nature knows how to manipulate information. And one of the most exciting things we've run into there is a notion of using quantum mechanics to compute. So rather than use a $1 billion factory to make the chip, we started wondering, could we just use natural materials to do the computing? And in doing that, we discovered a way to make quantum computers. So we made a simple computer that could unlock a small padlock, in effect, but the computer was a tube of chloroform. And the way this computer works is it's just a liquid, and we send a radio pulse into the liquid, and then we listen to a radio pulse coming back. And the way it gets transformed represents a computation done by the fluid. And not only that, but it's a new kind of much more powerful computation. So what's so interesting about this is it lets us access quantum mechanics to compute, but even better, the computer is essentially free. It costs pennies for the materials. For years, people have talked about nanotechnology and molecular machines, and it turns out we're surrounded by the means to compute. Nature already knows how to do it if you ask the right question, if you start to think in terms of what nature knows how to do rather than this constricting digital model.
Another thing you're working on along these lines is the shoe computer, really. Is it anything like Get Smarts?
Shoes are very interesting as a platform for computing. When you say shoe computer, you smile and you think of poor Max holding a shoe up. Well, we bumped into just how interesting footwear are. So let's think about your shoes. You probably haven't thought about them much today. But you have them with you. You don't have to remember to carry your shoes around, unlike your laptop, which you've got to drag around in your briefcase. The second interesting aspect of shoes is power. When you walk, you put watts of energy in the ground, a lot of power. And my colleague Joe Paradiso has been developing shoe inserts that recover that. So now instead of carrying a power supply for your laptop, you just have to walk. Then the third interesting piece is we've discovered that shoes can send data into your body, actually turning your body into a network. This was work I did with Tom Zimmerman, now at IBM. What that means is instead of taking your shoe off and having to hold it up, right off the bat, you could, say, have your wristwatch or eyeglasses as a display. So if you pause there, compare it to your laptop. Although you laughed when we said shoe computer, with your laptop, you've got to carry the laptop, you've got to carry the power supply, you've got to carry the modem cables. To use the laptop, you need a lap. You've got to sit down. The shoe computer tags along with you. Its job is to get the power. Its job is to figure out how to do input output through your body. Instead of you having to meet the needs of the technology, it's up to the technology to meet your needs. The most interesting part of the shoe computer of all is once you can send data through your body, you can send data through your body. And what I didn't even understand the importance of that until I noticed that visitors to my lab wouldn't let me stop working on it. Because with data in your body, for example, you can shake hands with somebody and exchange an electronic business card. So instead of pulling out a personal digital assistant and aiming it and pushing some buttons to send some data at a conference, we've spent centuries or millennia learning the protocol for how to approach each other and how to shake hands. Now we can attach the digital gesture to the physical gesture. Or when you touch a doorknob, you can authenticate. Or if you pick up a telephone, you can be downloading your messages while you're hearing your voicemail. Once again, pulling apart this distinction between real reality versus virtual reality, we take the physical world you live in and we endow digital content to your physical gestures. And that's the really interesting implication of putting the computing in the footwear.
We have been hearing about things like smart houses since the 60s, but the future never seems to become now. Why is that?
I think what's been wrong with smart houses is two things. One is the whole notion of how they're developed. They've generally been developed by middle-aged white males in suburban settings pretending to live in them. So they don't really reflect anybody's visceral passion and sense of what does it mean to live. And I think they've been too constrained to the wrong level of description in that they have this intrusive notion of injecting a few keyboards and monitors into a house that impede how you live your life and don't really take seriously this notion of embedding the technology invisibly. One of the things we're working towards is a refrigerator that has advanced chemical sensing, so it could say your milk is turning bad. And then if you had a shoe computer, the refrigerator could tell your shoe that the milk is turning bad. Now, at that moment, I don't want to know a thing about it. I'm late for work. I'm running out. But if I'm walking home and my shoe knows my schedule and the store tells it, oh, we have milk on sale and I have time, the shoe might say, oh, by the way, you're out of milk. You might want to get that. Now, if you look at that very simple example, it's not a breakthrough in artificial intelligence, and I didn't have to do anything, but I got the right information at the right time to solve a problem. And that's really what I've seen as missing in a lot of the attempts at injecting the technology in the home.
Neil Gershenfeld directs the MIT Media Lab's Physics and Media Group. His new book is When Things Start to Think. We're going to talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with computer scientist Neil Gershenfeld. His new book is When Things Start to Think. I'm curious what the Media Lab is like to work in.
Life in the Media Lab is very chaotic. There's another debate in our society right now between short-term research and long-term research. And for me, the Media Lab is something different still in that in industry, you carefully control visit traffic because you want to protect your secrets. In academia, you control visit traffic because you want to protect your freedom. And we have four or so groups in the building every single day coming through. But in a funny way, that heavy traffic frees me because I get to do whatever I want, but I get credit for being practical because they tell me what the stuff is good for. For example, a few years ago, we did a magic trick with Penn and Teller. We were playing with leaking fields through body, and we made this spirit cabinet to leak a field through Penn's body and contact Houdini. That was just great fun, not the sort of thing our sponsors do internally usually. But the next day, one of our sponsors, NEC, was in my lab telling us about child seats because this was the problem of airbags exploding and killing infants in rear-facing child seats. And they said, wow, that's a fancy seat. Could it solve this life and death problem? So we took the car seat, we took the instrumentation from the magic trick, put it in a car seat, and lo and behold, it did work. We really could make a seat that looks like a normal seat, but can describe the shape of the occupant sitting in it, and that's coming out in cars next year. Now, what I find interesting about that story is we would have never accepted child seat funding. It's too remote from what we do. They would have never funded magic tricks. It's too remote from what they do. What's needed is the proximity that lets us run into each other. And this notion that basic research goes to applied research, goes to products, goes to development, really impedes that sort of contact. And historically, many of the most interesting things really just don't happen that way.
A lot of your students are wearing wearable electronics. What do they have around their necks or embedded in their cheek?
Well, in fact, there's already a second generation. The first generation of cyborgs came up with cameras that they would see out through so that that were connected to displays in front of their eyes so that you could move your eyes around and look backwards on a bicycle or see in the dark or transform your visual field. You could connect your senses to the net so people could look out through your eyes and ears. You have all the information you ever lived with accessible around your waist or on the net so you can call up contextual information.
Does this stuff work reliably?
The first generation absolutely didn't. But these students were so unwilling to not have access to that sort of connectivity, they were willing to put up with the headaches. What's happening now with wearables is there's three vectors coming into the middle that let me predict that wearables will happen because it's really just a statement about the present. One is these students who want to have these capabilities. One is industrial pull. FedEx needs airplanes routed the instant a driver looks at a package. The repair manual for a 747 weighs 3 tons. So for those sorts of things, you need it. But the missing piece in the middle we've been finding is you can provide the means of wearable computing without the clutter. Things like electronic inks and fabrics and sewn circuitry give you the capabilities of wearable computing, and all you have to wear is normal clothing and normal glasses to get access to that capability so that you don't need to live like a cyborg to do that. And once you do that, something very interesting happens. Once you have that sort of connectivity, it's only really a small stretch to see it as a new evolutionary stage in how we work as a species, and that life has been defined by the organization of communication. It was a big step for molecules to form cells and cells to form organs and organs to form creatures and creatures, families and families, communities. And each of those you view as a step in the evolution of life. Well, this new generation of cyborgs has a continuous community that's no longer constrained by being local. They can be in touch with somebody a foot from them or around the world continuously. So with that richer notion of community, it really is a new stage in how we interact as a species.
What does conducting fabric do for me?
What it does for you is electrical engineers try to make flexible circuits by rigidly attaching chips to materials that can bend. But they really don't bend very much. You really wouldn't want to have that close to you. If you wanted to have that sort of capability, so if you wanted to make a cell phone call without pulling out a cell phone and pushing buttons, but just talking and have your shirt collar listen, right now you wouldn't want to strap a cell phone around your neck. What this conducting thread and fabric does is let us make the ultimate in flex circuitry by making what looks and feels like fabric, but the threads themselves are part of the circuitry.
And where are you with that right now? What capability do your students have with their wearables?
With the flexible circuitry, we're just starting to make ones. We've been doing demonstration exercise, making little keyboards and little radios, and we're just starting to make complete systems, like, for example, a cell phone that's sewn into a jacket. One of the first things the students did was they made a boombox. They made a musical jacket that you can play your music just by interacting with embroidery on the jacket.
I have to ask you this, Neil. At home, are you wearing these electronic shirts and talking to people in your shirt collar?
Oh, almost not at all. At home, I've got a great reality check. My wife used to be a piano tuner, and she has a PhD in English literature. And I view almost any gadget as a wonderful thing unless I'm convinced otherwise. And she takes exactly the opposite approach. She likes traditional technology unless she's really convinced it's replacing it. So I really have to work very hard to convince her that the new stuff is worth having around the house. And she's a very good reality check on that.
Well, thanks very much for talking today. I enjoyed it.
Good. It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed your questions.
Neil Gershenfeld's new book is When Things Start to Think. He co-directs the Things That Think Research Consortium at the MIT Media Laboratory. This is Fresh Air.